You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, congressional offices are getting a ton of email from constituents, but the technology to handle all those messages is out of date. We'll learn about some possible fixes.
First, a Syrian refugee living in Wisconsin is challenging President Trump's refugee and immigration ban in federal court. The plaintiff, who is remaining anonymous to safeguard his family still in Syria, maintains that the ban violates federal law and is unconstitutional.
Andre Vrabi is an attorney with Holwell, Schuster & Goldberg, LLP in New York. He's representing the Syrian man living in Wisconsin who's filed the suit. Andre, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us about your client. How did he first come to seek asylum here in the United States?
Sure. So my client came roughly 3 years ago, and he was escaping really harrowing conditions in Syria. He's from Aleppo and had been tortured, imprisoned, beaten to the point of hospitalization, had had threats against himself and his wife, particularly one armed group said that they knew who his wife was and would rape her when they found her. And under these conditions, my client came to the United States and immediately requested asylum. And following a vetting process where the United States government satisfied itself that he's not a danger to the United States, that he is who he says he is, he was granted asylum status by an immigration judge in Chicago. And immediately after that, he filed the petition that forms the basis for this particular case, which is a petition for derivative asylum status for his young wife and his three-year-old daughter.
And as we noted, he's remaining anonymous in this case. It may seem obvious, but tell us why it's important that he stay anonymous.
Sure. My client has particularized credible threats from armed groups in Syria that they will find, if not him, his family, and they will do great harm to them. And frankly, the only thing that he wants more than to be reunited with his little girl and with his wife is to make sure that they're safe. And alerting these armed groups to the fact that he's still alive, that he's got asylum status, and that he's in the United States would really jeopardize them. And to that end, the judge in this case, Judge Conley, the chief judge in the Western District of Wisconsin, agreed with us that it would be prudent to permit my client to proceed anonymously, finding that he would be in grave danger, and his wife and young daughter would be in grave danger, should he be required to disclose his identity publicly. That said, we have provided the government with his full name and identifying characteristics such that they would be able to know who the plaintiff is, and the conditions of his petition would be reviewed by the government.
What was the status of his petition to bring his wife and daughter over before this executive ban came into place?
It was pending, and by all accounts, it was moving forward expeditiously. My client, as any other petitioner for derivative asylum, essentially has to provide documentation and to satisfy the U.S. authorities of two things. The first is that the beneficiaries, in this case, his little girl and his wife, are who my client says they are in relation particularly to him as the petitioner. In other words, that this is truly his wife and this is truly his little girl. The second component that my client has to demonstrate is that his beneficiaries are not a threat to the United States or the community here. In other words, that from a security and national security perspective, they're appropriate beneficiaries of the derivative asylum petition. That, too, has been satisfied from what we understand. And his particular petition is actually at the very last part of the process, the ministerial part of the process, And was in that position when President Trump signed the executive order.
And what impact did that executive order then have on this petition?
I mean, you could think of it in terms of a kind of a 3-year marathon for my client. I mean, he escaped terrible conditions, worked tirelessly to get his wife and his son and daughter, sadly his son has already been killed, to the United States. And at the point where he could see the finish line to this marathon, which was January of 2017, this petition ground to a halt. The government has indicated in documents that are publicly available and which we have included in our moving papers for a temporary restraining order in court that it will not be processing these derivative asylum petitions. And even if it does process those derivative asylum petitions, another branch of the government said it will not be issuing visas or travel documents that would permit the beneficiaries of an approved petition, in this case, my client's daughter and his wife, to actually travel to the United States.
We've seen court rulings elsewhere in the country putting a halt, we hear, to this executive order, at least to key parts of it. Does that not affect your client and his family?
That's a very good question. The lack of clarity is very troubling for us. And given this administration's animus and what we think are the true purposes behind the executive order, we thought it was prudent to bring this case to ensure that our clients' rights are protected. Specifically, the broadest injunctive relief that has been granted was from a court in Washington, a district court there. And the court said there is a nationwide ban on particular provisions of the executive order, but it also said that the nationwide ban is at ports of entry. And the documents to which I referred previously that we've seen from the Department of Homeland Security and the State Department indicate to us that the way that the administration intends to interpret this temporary restraining order is to say the government will not apply the executive order at ports of entry, meaning perhaps airports or marine ports, but that doesn't do anything for my client who's already here and has put his petition not in a port of entry, but rather within the United States in the office in, I believe it is Milwaukee, the office in Wisconsin that processes these types of petitions.
We're talking to Andre Vrabi. He's an attorney representing a Syrian refugee living in Wisconsin who's challenging President Donald Trump's refugee and immigration ban. Andre, what are the grounds that you're filing this challenge on?
We're arguing both statutory and constitutional violations. First, on the statutory point, the Immigration and Nationality Act, as it currently stands, was passed by Congress, was amended by Congress, and lays out a framework for immigration into this country. One of the governing principles within that act, and statutorily one of the ones that are found within particular sections of that act, state that it's the federal government's intention to ensure that families of asylum seekers are kept together. In our particular case, that obviously is being frustrated by the executive order. The provision that President Trump read to the press, I believe verbatim, that has to do with the president's right to suspend or block the entry of aliens or classes of aliens into the United States, that's a provision within the INA, was passed in 1952. However, in 1965, Congress amended the INA to ensure that derivative asylees, and refugees generally will not be prohibited from entering the United States based on a policy of discrimination for either their religious beliefs or their nationality. And we argue that the provisions of the executive order clearly violate this limitation that Congress has imposed on the president. Separate and apart from that, of course, are constitutional protections that anyone that resides within the United States is entitled to. Those protections include the First Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, what are sometimes called equal protection, due process, and establishment clause protections. And we've also made arguments, legal arguments, that substantiate our position that our clients' constitutional rights have been violated. In particular, the U.S. Constitution protects what's called a right to family integrity, separate and apart from the provisions of the INA. And through the government's decision or its policy or its failure to act on a valid petition to bring the wife and this little girl over, they have violated that right of our client.
As we wrap up, what are the next steps now in court? What's the timeline for this challenge?
So we've had some great developments recently. The court yesterday issued an order, first continuing to permit us to proceed anonymously and not divulge our client's identity. But even more importantly, the court has allowed has required the federal government within this week, so by the end of this week, Friday, has stated to the federal government that they must answer three basic questions, which really go to the heart of our case. The first one asks, what's the current status of this plaintiff's request for derivative asylum for his wife and daughter? The second one asks, does the United States government intend to continue processing derivative asylum applications for beneficiaries even after the issuance of the executive order? And the third one asks whether the preliminary injunction entered into by the court in Seattle and left in place by the Ninth Circuit thus far applies to derivative asylum petitions for beneficiaries from Syria, which are, of course, the class of people that my client's wife and daughter fall into.
We'll leave it there for now. Andre, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. You know, I have to say that it's a very sweeping executive order, and I do appreciate the fact that you are letting the public know that there are many different types of individuals that have been targeted here, like my client and his young wife and little daughter, that have nothing to do with terrorism and really are harmed by the executive order.
That's attorney Andre Vrabi representing the Syrian refugee living in Wisconsin who's challenging the president's refugee and immigration ban.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at how congressional offices are trying to keep up with the deluge of phone calls and emails from constituents. The technology to deal with all this communication is outdated.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Anytime is booyah time in northeastern Wisconsin. But Chris Cerugi finds it particularly good when the snow flies.
The leaves have fallen, flurries whip past the window, and it's time for another season. I am, of course, referring to soup season. There's nothing better than boiling up a pot of soup on a cold, dark day that brings cheer to any room. The aroma wafts around corners, drifts down hallways from kitchen to great room to bedroom. To me, fall and winter is soup time, but there's a tradition here in northeast Wisconsin in which soup is cooked all year in a traditional style. It may be 90 degrees outside, but a neighbor or a church will be cooking a pot of booyah, chicken booyah. The delectable main dish can't be found in California or Colorado or any other state unless, of course, some person is a Wisconsin transplant with a Belgian heritage. Still, the frost whitens the grass, and it is time to gather ingredients for chicken booyah. I wonder just what the difference is between booyah and chicken soup. They both call for chicken, they both have vegetables, and they both simmer for hours. So, I did what any person seeking answers would do. I went online and checked with my mom for the fine points. Belgium immigrants settled the shores of Lake Michigan in northeast Wisconsin. Here they carried on their European soup tradition, and the word booyah comes from either the French or Walloon language spoken by them. There are many variations of the recipe. Some called for herbs. Many stated that the chicken must be stewing chickens and not fryers. As for preparation, my mom has her own process. After she's cooked the meat for hours and deboned it, she smashes the meat into stringy, broth-infused morsels with a potato masher. My brother-in-law, once seeing my mother crunching the meat in such a manner, informed her that the animals were already dead. She took the jibe in stride and continued mashing. Of course, there's the debate among bouillabaisse connoisseurs about the ingredients and how best to make the soup. However, there's also a local debate among cooks about whether to add cabbage. An unsubstantiated belief claims that adding cabbage ruins the soup for storage. My mother adds cabbage, and therefore, so will I. Now the pot, chucked full of meat, vegetables, and simmering broth, is ready. The aroma begins its journey throughout the house. Now, some non-Wisconsinites might just call this chicken soup. However, in this northeast part of the state, bouillabaisse is the soup du jour. It's a meal created in a large pot, stewed all day, and may be carted home from church picnics or bazaars in plastic containers. Ah, the aroma alone is delicious. Soup's on!
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
It's easier than ever to send a message to Congress thanks to apps and email, but congressional offices are swamped by the amount of phone calls, emails, letters, and tweets coming at them every day.
And the technology to deal with all this mail is antiquated. According to the OpenGov Foundation, they've studied this problem.
Seamus Kraft joins us. He's executive director of the OpenGov Foundation. He co-founded this civic technology organization 4 years ago with Republican U.S. Congressman Daryl Issa of California. Seamus, welcome to Central Time.
It's wonderful to be here with you. Thank you.
Leading up to the confirmation vote of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, one senator said he got 50,000 emails, and the Capitol switchboard was jammed at one point, and that wreaked havoc then on the Senate's voicemail system. How is technology holding up in congressional offices?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that it's not holding up. Congress is in the middle of a decades-long slow-motion healthcare.gov-style crisis of its information technology, its systems, its staffing. And it's not just the mail. It's not just the phones. Remember, these are the means for securing the public's right, its First Amendment right, to petition your government for the redress of grievances. And I think that anybody who's tried to call your congressman, anybody who's written a letter and not gotten a response or sent a tweet and never heard anything back knows exactly what we're talking about. But the worst part about this is it's just as bad for the folks who serve inside of the institution, young, hardworking staffers who are trying to represent the views of their constituents. They're trying to engage, and Congress just hasn't given them the tools to do their job. You know, that's the bad news. I think the good news is that this is totally fixable. It's not any one person or party's fault, but I think we've gotten to a place where it's everybody's responsibility to fix it.
And over the past decade, what has happened to the growth of email?
Oh, good gracious. It's exploding. You know, I served as a junior staffer for 4 years in the institution before we started the OpenGov Foundation, and it's mind-boggling, the growth of email, the growth of digital communications. And that's totally understandable because technology has become the critical infrastructure of our personal lives, of our educational lives, heck, with Tinder, right, even our love lives. It just hasn't been brought to bear on the institution. I mean, mail has gone up, email has gone up 548% over the last decade, and that's a change that's not turning around. You know, the internet is out of the bottle. It's not going back. Congress just hasn't caught up.
So what is the fix here? How could they fix the communication?
Well, the good news is that there are solutions all around us. You know, I'm talking to you right now on an iPhone. We use mobile communications to conduct banking, to conduct everything else in our life. Solutions exist. It just is now a challenge of getting those solutions into the institution and adapting the rules and the culture to fit. Right up on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, you know, just about a mile from Congress, President Obama pioneered how to do this, how to get it done with his signature technology teams called the U.S. Digital Service and 18F. If you remember that healthcare.gov collapse, he brought in experts from the technology, data, and design communities, paired them up with long-term government veterans who knew how the bureaucracy worked, and look at the better service that was delivered to the American people. Congress just needs to look up at the White House, look up at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and bring that power of modern technology in-house.
And your organization, the Open Gov Foundation, said Congress spent $288 million on technology in 2014. So why isn't there a sophisticated system that can handle all this mail?
That's a great question. And it's one I think that is perhaps beyond my understanding, because clearly the money's there. And remember, that $288 million is the floor. That's what we were able to find. But we had to navigate Congress's paper-based systems just to get there. And that's why we've been pulling together a plan to help Congress enter the Internet age called the Congressional Digital Service, right? So adapting the pioneering work of President Obama's tech teams to the wild and woolly world that is the U.S. Congress, all with the point of helping the public access their legislators, hold them accountable, and really have their views represented in government. It's really that important, but the solutions are right there in front of us.
And really quickly before we let you go, is it worthwhile for people to send that letter to write their representatives in Washington? Because what are the chances of that message being read or responded to?
Well, it's evident that our government needs help, and it's not just the good ideas from lawyers and lobbyists. We need the best ideas from the public, right? Your fundamental right to petition your government for the redress of grievances is what separates the United States of America. Call your congressman, show up at town halls, tweet them, fax them, send a passenger pigeon.
We're going to have to stop you there. That was Seamus Kraft, co-founder of the Open Gov Foundation, a nonpartisan, nonprofit civic technology firm. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up after 7 on the Moth Radio Hour, the victim of a random stabbing struggles to reestablish his life while suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. An author describes coming of age at 19 while traveling through Europe to witness the fall of the Berlin Wall. And an artist loses 3 years of work in an instant and finds it hard to continue. Those stories are on the Moth tonight after 7.
Now, with Donald Trump's win and majorities in both houses of Congress, the GOP is well positioned to implement policies to advance their priorities on things like immigration, national security, the economy, social issues, and more.
Our next guest says they shouldn't squander that opportunity, and they need to act quickly and decisively to have some big wins under their belt in time for the 2018 elections.
Hugh Hewitt joins us now. He's a prominent voice in conservative media with a nationally syndicated show heard in more than 120 markets around the U.S. every weekday morning. He interviewed then-candidate Trump 15 times during the presidential election season, and his new book is The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority. Hugh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, Kate, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Talk about this opportunity for Republicans, for conservatives. How significant is this?
Well, my motto is go big, go far, go fast. They've only had two opportunities in the last 40 years to act with a unified GOP government. Briefly in 2001, until Senator Jim Jeffords changed parties in June of that year. And then in 2005, which was the horrible year, the year of Terry Schiavo, of Katrina, of the collapse of Iraq, of Harriet Myers, of a Social Security initiative that was poorly thought out and poorly executed. So we learned from 2001 that you can't dawdle. Things change. Bad things happen to good people, and majorities can vanish. And we learned from 2005 you have to pick your agenda and not make unforced errors, as was the Teresa Schiavo error, in retrospect, a terrible error. You can't take for granted conservative support, as Harriet Myers shown. You have to be on the scene when disaster happens, as Katrina shown. You have to pay attention to international affairs, and the surge should have been a year early, but it was successful when it came. But that is all in the fourth way. The fourth way is all about not repeating the mistakes of the past and effectively governing as Scott Walker has done up in Wisconsin.
A lot of your book is specific policy recommendations, but you also talk about style. You say Donald Trump and Paul Ryan and others should govern, quoting here, inclusively, energetically, and joyously, celebrating freedom and prosperity. How important is that approach, that style of governing?
I call it singing in the key of we, and it is so central to my experience of successful Republican governments. I was a young man in the Reagan administration, a briefcase-carrying junior lawyer in the White House counsel's office during President Reagan's first and second terms, and I noted then that it's just much easier to work in Washington when everything isn't bitter, everything isn't divisive, everything isn't a knife fight. Right now, we are in the most divided time of my lifetime. It's not the most divided in American history, and we've had rough patches before, but this is truly broken glass on bottle edge from the start, and unfortunate. It can be turned around, but it takes some gestures. It takes some climbing down on both sides from rhetorical sword fights.
You write about this in the book. This is no secret. You had serious reservations about candidate Donald Trump. Didn't like him as the top choice for the party. Were ready to step away from him, even as the nominee after the Access Hollywood tapes. Looking at his style as a candidate, as a business person for that matter, as a president so far, is he the guy who can govern inclusively, energetically, and joyously?
Yeah, he's had a intermittent beginning. It's not all bad. It's not all good. Just to recap, I was neutral during the debates. I did four presidential debates, so I was rigorously neutral and interviewed, including beginning with Scott Walker, on all of the Republican candidates, 170 interviews on my radio show, 15 of them with then-candidate Trump. Those four debates were a revelation, but I was fair throughout. Afterwards, I endorsed him. I was very critical of the attack on Judge Curiel. You know, I'm a lawyer, and I am very steeped in the ways that Article 3 deserves the respect and deference of Articles 1 and 2 in the constitutional system. I was critical of President Trump again when he suggested that the judge in Seattle who enjoined his order was a so-called judge. I'm trying to use my platforms to impart to a businessman the way that one treats the federal judiciary, if only out of prudence. Not only is it appropriate, it's prudent to do so. They are federal judges, and near to God, they do not come. But I also, after Access Hollywood, I called on him to drop out of the race. He didn't, but I voted for him, and I'm very happy I did, if only because of Neil Gorsuch, at least as qualified as anybody else in the United States for that job. There are other people who are as qualified as Judge Gorsuch. I don't mean to imply other people are inferior, but he is as good as it gets when it comes to a Supreme Court nominee for an originalist like me.
Talking to Hugh Hewitt, his new book is The Fourth Way, the Conservative Playbook for a Lasting GOP Majority. I want to get into some of your policy suggestions. You have an interesting take on infrastructure and what President Trump and Republicans in Congress could do with this. A smaller amount of money than we saw at the outset of the Obama administration, but trying to leverage it into meaningful local development. Can you talk about what you have in mind?
Yeah, I have served for 18 years on a local infrastructure board that receives cigarette tax monies in California. And it's only $30 million a year, which is, you know, real money at the county level. It doesn't make much difference to people at the federal level. But if you're being asked to take care, as we are, we're charged by statute with taking care of children 0 to 5, making sure they're ready and healthy to learn by the time they go to school, you can do a lot of great things if you get 9 volunteers, as we are. And we meet monthly, and we spend that money with a very small staff. I believe that in every community in Wisconsin, on a county-by-county basis, they know what needs to be done. And so my infrastructure spending plan is very different from the President Obama, President Biden top-down plan. It would push the money out to the counties, to new boards of volunteers who aren't getting paid, aren't racking up government benefits, and tell them they have to spend the money in 5 years, and preferably 25% of it in the first year and the rest to endow that which they have begun, so that there are lasting monuments. And I'm not sure if either of you come from a town with a Carnegie Library, as I did. And
My wife works at a Carnegie Library, actually.
Oh, does she really?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I use that as an example in the book. I grew up going to a Carnegie Library, and I'm not recommending that we need another series of Carnegie libraries, but those were infrastructure improvements in local communities that can be repurposed as the years go by. Is it still serving as a library?
It is,
Rob?
It is, yep.
The one in Warren, Ohio, where I grew up, has been repurposed a couple of times, but it is a magnificent legacy for Carnegie, and it's what physical buildings do. I'm a Republican, but I love the WPA, because the WPA actually built things that are still in use today, including the pool and park complex where I had my first job, you know, a million years ago at age 16. And I just believe in not feathering nests, not rebating money, but in actually putting people to work, building public health infrastructure. That's my primary focus of the book.
We're talking with conservative broadcast journalist Hugh Hewitt, looking at the Trump administration, the GOP majority in Congress, talking about his new book. It's called The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you hope to see from a Republican Congress and White House? What issues are most important to you that you want to see addressed? And do you agree with our guest that fast and decisive action is key to success? Or are you hoping for a more measured approach? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation now with conservative broadcast journalist Hugh Hewitt. His new book is The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think President Trump and Republicans in Congress will be able to work together successfully? What opportunities and challenges do you see for them? What would success look like for you as the GOP implements its priorities? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. We've got Mike with us in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hi. I guess my biggest priority is that the southern border gets secured and made strong. I work with in the roofing industry, and I work with a lot of Mexican guys. And each one of them, without exception, reiterates that exact same sentiment that we need to secure that border. And so I guess I'd just like to hear what Hugh has to say about that.
Mike, thanks for the call. You have an immigration plan in the book. Hugh, tell us about border security and purple cards.
Well, I have lived in the Southern California for many years, and I've crossed the Mexican border in Tijuana and San Diego and the Otay Mesa many, many times, and I know that fences work. And I've been an advocate of a double-sided long fence. Now, the Mexican-American border is 2,000 miles long. Half of it's impassable by virtue of mountain ranges and lakes. But of that 1,000 miles, I would like to see a double long, strong, high double fence with a road running between it. And President Trump promised that. He ran on it. It's his signature promise. It should be appropriated. It was authorized in 2006, by the way. It just was never built. 33 miles of it was built. And so it needs to get done, and it will not solve all of illegal immigration across the border, nor drug cartels tunneling, but it will cut down 80 to 90% of the foot traffic, and that allows the Border Patrol and the Immigration Custom Enforcement to focus on the other 20%. But I am also a regularization fan. I am pleased that President Trump has not withdrawn the DACA executive order. I don't think we ought to be sending those kids home. I do also believe that we ought to regularize anyone in the country who is not here legally and who has been a model resident of the United States and not in trouble with the law and going to work, and that we ought to give them the purple card. And that's just a, you know, it's not a green card. It's not permanent residence. Because if you do get in trouble and you've entered the country legally, I think you ought to have a lesser set of rights than a green card holder does, a permanent resident who's entered legally. And if you want a green card, you ought to go home and stand in line behind the people who you cut in line in front of, because equity informs all of us that if you want to be a citizen, you ought to enter as would-be citizens do enter legally. So I do believe that 90% of the country agrees with 90% of my agenda and has for a long time.
But key supporters of Donald Trump in this election might look at that purple card idea, even though it's not even a green card, it's not a path to citizenship. They might say it's amnesty-ish.
They might, Rob, but I believe that Nixon to China is a phrase that would apply to Donald Trump doing immigration reform. He's invulnerable on it. No one can accuse Donald Trump, at least for long or persuasively, of being soft on illegal immigration, no matter what he does. Even if he says they're all in free, he still could resist a charge of amnesty. And so he is uniquely positioned of anyone in the last, since Reagan's amnesty, and it was an amnesty in 1986, Donald Trump is uniquely positioned to be generous in this area.
Mike, thanks for that call. We'll go back to our callers now with Gary on the line in Fitchburg. Gary, hi.
Hi. One of the things I did not like about Mr. Obama's policies was his approach to helping to ramp up war in Syria, as well as bombing or droning seven countries. And I would like to see President Trump withdraw from our adventurism around the world, use those dollars for high-speed trains, rejuvenate our energy grid, and organic farms.
Gary, thanks for the call. Less military, use that money for infrastructure. You talk about infrastructure and the military, Hugh, in the book.
Yes, Gary didn't vote for Mr. Trump, obviously, because Mr. Trump campaigned for a 350-ship Navy, and that's vital to reasserting American leadership in the world. The oceans haven't shrunk, but our Navy has, down to 282 combatant ships, 272, depending on how you count. He gave a speech at the Philadelphia shipyard, which he said 350 is his number. He's got to make that number. It's a marker. He put it down. And so we'll be building a lot of ships. And what we did in Syria by erasing the red line led to a genocide. And that genocide will define President Obama's legacy, Ben Rhodes' legacy, Susan Rice's legacy, John Kerry's legacy. Nothing else lasts in history like a genocide. And Bill Clinton knows that vis-a-vis Rwanda. Jerry Ford knows it vis-a-vis Cambodia. FDR knows it vis-a-vis Germany, and a genocide occurred in Syria, and it's almost unbelievable that America stood on the sidelines and watched.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to John in Baraboo. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been listening to Hugh, some great ideas with your purple card ideas and the amnesty stuff. My question would be regarding the process to become a legal alien, which I'm just speaking just from hearsay now, and it's almost 10 years for people to get an actual citizenship. And I'm thinking, okay, it's great if we send these people back to the end of the line, because obviously they did jump ahead, but now we're looking at 10 and 15 years at such a backlog, it's almost unbelievable.
John, thanks for the call. So, Hugh, legal immigrants trying to get citizenship, John's saying maybe streamline that.
I think he's right. There are numerous areas where the United States ought to cherry-pick immigrants for the benefit of the country as a whole. There are, and I've never been one to join the anti-H-1B-1 visa chorus. There are lots of smart people who want to come to the United States. If they want to come to the United States, because we have the intellectual infrastructure to make greatest advantage of their gifts, let them come. We have doctors, for example, the Cleveland Clinic being the greatest hospital in the world. I'm from Ohio. If you've got superb heart surgeons who want to train around the world at the Cleveland Clinic and some of them want to stay, olly in free. That helps everyone down the road who's going to need a heart transplant. And I'm just a great believer in allowing the greatest talent in the world to come to the country where the greatest opportunities abound for expanding on that talent. Why not?
Thanks a lot for the call. John, briefly as we wrap up, Hugh, very optimistic for the most part in the book. You have some concerns, some fears. 1 month in or so, almost a month into the Trump presidency, still optimistic?
I am. The last chapter of the fourth way is about impeachment, because David Brooks predicted it within 1 year. I don't think it's likely to happen unless Democrats reclaim Congress. But I am an optimist. We just recently stole from Marquette Law School the dean from your law school to my law school at Chapman University, Matt Parlow. And Russ Feingold's coming out here next week. And we will be stealing everything we can from Wisconsin to make California a better place. I am an optimist because people move around this country and go do what's best for them and for the country. So I think we'll get through the rough patch and be fine.
We'll put up a wall and keep our talent in here in Wisconsin. Hugh, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Guy. Goodbye.
That was Hugh Hewitt. His new book is The Fourth Way, the conservative playbook for a lasting GOP majority.
A national group that wants lower taxes says costly cigarettes encourage smuggling. But health groups say higher taxes reduce cigarette sales and discourage smoking. Caught in between are smokers who pay the taxes and states that rely on that revenue. Shemaine Mills reports.
Last year, just under 5% of the state's revenue came from what are sometimes called vice taxes on cigarettes, tobacco products, liquor, wine, and beer. Most of that revenue, $573 million, came from cigarette taxes. The tax on a pack is $2.52 in Wisconsin, making it the 10th highest in the country. Former Governor Jim Doyle boosted it to that level in 2009, and it hasn't budged since, either up or down. But the National Tax Foundation, best known for its Tax Freedom Day, likens high cigarette taxes to de facto prohibition. Joe Henchman is with the foundation.
Wisconsin's number nine in terms of the amount of smuggling happening, and that's when you have so many people buying their cigarettes outside of legal channels. That suggests something similar to what we encountered in prohibition in the country.
Donna Wininski is with the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. She scoffs at the prohibition comparison.
No, I disagree. Cigarettes are probably one of the easiest products to get anywhere. They're sold in every convenience store, in just about every pharmacy. You can't say that a product that is that readily available is approaching prohibition. Is it getting pricey? Sure it is.
On a cold winter day, it's hard to tell the smokers from those who are just breathing. Everyone's exhaling small white puffs from their mouth as they stroll on State Street near campus or wait for a bus. But 35-year-old Angela Poyna-Turner of Madison is one of the few people smoking. He tries not to smoke in front of others. It's a courtesy thing, he says, but sometimes he does. He's hooked.
When I wake up in the morning, I usually smoke a cigarette right away. After meals, when I'm driving, before I go to bed, if I'm stressing a lot.
Turner says if a pack of cigarettes was more than $10, he'd likely quit. He doesn't know how much tax he pays on each pack. He just knows the overall cost is, in his words, way too expensive.
When I first started smoking, cigarettes were like $5.50, $6. Now it's almost between $8 and $9 for a pack of cigarettes.
Wininski says as price goes up, sales tend to go down, but not across the board.
When the price of tobacco products go up, that discourages kids in particular from smoking. It has a little less impact on adults, but we even see adults decrease their smoking when the price goes up.
And that means less revenue for tobacco companies. In Wisconsin, cigarette sales have been going down as prices go up. In 2009, 313 million packs were sold, compared to 229 million packs in 2014. Those numbers reflect legitimate purchases in which taxes were paid. Not counted are illegal online sales and cigarettes smuggled in from other places. The Tax Foundation says nearly 27% of cigarettes consumed in Wisconsin are smuggled in. But the state's figures are much lower, anywhere between 5 and 7%. So smuggling rates and their link to taxes depend on who you ask. Currently, no elected officials in Wisconsin are talking about higher taxes on cigarettes, and it's a hard sell for health advocates who have powerful opponents in the tobacco industry and groups like the Tax Foundation who want lower taxes. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.